Your people have rejected your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets. I alone am left, and now they seek to take my life.
How long will you people waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. If Baal, follow him.
Aneni Adonai Aneni, Viadu Ha'am Hazeh, Ki Ata Adonai Ha'Elohim.
I will have my revenge, Elijah. By this time tomorrow, you'll be as dead as any one of those prophets.
Why did you ever come here? A holy man barging in, exposing my sin and killing my son.
Give me your son. Adonai Elohai Tashamna, Nefesh HaYelet HaZev. I am the only one of the Lord's prophets left, but Baal has 450. Let them call on the name of their God. I will call on the name of the Lord. The God who answers by fire, he is God.
So Elijah, in 1 Kings 17 and 18, he is presented as the dude. He is the prophet, the man of God. That seems like almost a superhero kind of figure. There's a scene where King Ahab is riding along in his chariot, and Elijah is able to outrun him over a distance of some 30 kilometers. Israel has been experiencing this huge, dramatic drought for 3.5 years. And it's Elijah who is able to go and stand on the mountain and in prayer invoke the name of the Lord, and the drought is ended with this massive rainstorm. It's Elijah who's able to test the 450 prophets of Baal by this contest. And it's beautifully told there in the previous chapter in 1 Kings 18. And so when we arrive here in 1 Kings 19, and Elijah is just, it seems, overwhelmed by the world, moving from that height of being able to be in control, to be the central figure of faithfulness and honoring the name of the Lord. And now, in 1 Kings 19, he just cries out to God saying, Lord, just take my life, get it over and done with. If you're not going to remain faithful to me, what's the point of continuing to live? And so he goes from this ecstatic experience of being fully in control into the depths of depression, where he just cannot see a future for himself. So Elijah becomes, for the church, this prophetic sign. We don't always have to have it together. We don't always have to be fully in control of our lives. Sometimes there will be things that seem to go so wrong that we just are overwhelmed and overcome by them. And like Elijah, we might experience the depths of this depression. And so he travels down to Beersheba, the southernmost point in the kingdom of Judah. He had been up in the northern kingdom of Israel, where King Ahab was the king. And so he moves there, and then he goes off into a day's wilderness, leaving his servant behind. And there the angel of the Lord appears to him in the midst of this depression and says, Elijah, you need to eat and drink. Clearly he's even forgotten to do those basic human things. Because the angel says, the journey will be too much for you. This sense of being in communion with the Lord, allowing the Word of God and the sacraments of the church to feed us and nourish us, is the essential thing that all of us need to do. And so strengthened by this, we're told that Elijah alone continues down into the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights, this normal symbolic experience of the long journey, the long period of time. And he arrives finally, we're told in our reading today, on the slopes of Mount Horeb, also of course called Mount Sinai, the mountain of God, the place where Moses had first encountered the Lord back in Exodus 3, and where he'd brought the people after they'd been freed from the slavery of Egypt and on the slopes of Mount Sinai, the covenant had been received by the people. So here is Elijah on the edge of the mountain. The Lord says, go to the cave. Go to that place where I appeared before Moses. We read that story back in the book of Exodus, in chapter 33, around verses 18 to 23. And there we're told that Moses wanted to see the glory of the Lord. And God said, no, Moses, you can't receive that glory, but go into that cave, go into the cleft of the rock that I will show you, and I will shield you, but allow the full glory of me to go before you. And so just in a similar way, Moses perhaps is expecting the presence of God to be in these spectacular signs, as he's seen already in the fire, in the storm, in the wind. Instead, we're told that as Elijah is there on the edge of the mountain, looking out, first, there's this massive storm that comes. Pretty dramatically told as well, the sense of this storm so strong and so powerful that the rocks on the mountain are split and shattered by it. No small wonder that Elijah retreats back inside the cave at this point to be shielded from this massive storm. Of course, the storm is mainly about the things you hear. You hear the thunder in the distance. You hear the sound of the wind as it howls around your house. You hear the sound of the rain as it falls around and on your roof. And so first, we're told about this sense of the hearing, that God is not there in these dramatic things that are heard. Next, it's a thing that is felt, the earthquake, as the earth around us trembles and shakes. But the Lord is not there in this mighty action of the earthquake. And then finally, the sign of the fire. Again, a usual sign of the presence of God, something that you're able to see and be able to be clearly drawn into. But again, the Lord is not present in those three signs, the things you hear, the things you feel, the things that you see. But instead, we're told that after all of this, in front of the presence of Elijah, there passed the very presence of Yahweh, of the Lord. And in the sound of sheer silence, the sound of the still small voice, the King James Version translates it, this sense of the God who's not always there in these big and dramatic signs, but the God who will be there, the God who is there at times in the still small voice and the sound of silence, in the ordinary encounters that we find within our lives. And so this powerful sense that God is wanting to remind us that he will be there through thick and fast. He will always be there present in our lives. Sometimes we're looking for the big and dramatic signs, but God may be saying, no, I will be there simply in the stillness of your heart. I will be there calling you and inviting you back into life. In a similar way, in our gospel today, we're told that Jesus, after the miraculous feeding of the 5,000 that we heard last week, sends the disciples away so that he, in turn, could then dismiss the crowds. And then he goes up to the mountain to be by himself and pray. So even though we're here in Matthew chapter 14, verse 23, this is the first time in the gospel that we've heard Jesus go by himself to pray. And so we know it's significant that he's there in communion with the Father, calling upon the name of the Lord. Meanwhile, the disciples have gone off, and we're told in the Greek that they're many stradia, a long distance out into the center of the lake. And so they're there, the storm winds are beginning to blow, the boat is beginning to be rocked and tossed around on the waves, and they're just overcome, petrified by the sudden storm that has erupted in the middle of the lake. And then we're told it's at the fourth watch of the night. It's the darkest period of the night. It's the longest time since the daylight. It's between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. And they're there just overcome by trying to battle the waves and the wind. And there in the distance, they see this figure approaching, and of course they're freaked out by this. They're overcome again by fear. It must be a ghost that's walking across the waves. Who else can do that? And of course it's Peter who first recognizes a possibility that this might be the one that they love. This might be in fact Jesus. And so he calls out, is it you? And Jesus says, courage, do not be afraid. Yes, I am. I am he. That great sign of the Lord's presence within the community. Peter's still not sure though. Peter says, Lord, if it is you, note the doubt, note that questioning, note the heart that is caught up in all kinds of questions. And what does he do? He tempts Jesus. He tests him. He says, well, if it is you, then call me. Invite me to come to you across the water. Now, for us, of course, the miracle seems to be that Jesus is defying the laws of gravity, that he's able to stand buoyantly there above the waters. But in the Jewish mythology, in the Jewish understanding, the waters were the sign of chaos. The waters were the sign of fear, of all things that could go wrong in the world. And so Jesus wasn't so much defying gravity, but he was standing in authority and control and power over all those forces that infect us and inflict upon themselves upon us in our world. And so Peter is in fact tempting Jesus to do the same, to have the same authority that only God has. In the Psalms, for example, we're told that God is able to walk on the waters. Again, the waters of chaos, the waters of destruction. So Peter is asking Jesus, can I act like God in the moment? Can I walk to you and be as equal to you? This source of temptation. Interestingly, Jesus says, come. He invites him. He allows Peter to be tempted in the midst of all of this. And so Peter gets out of the boat and begins to walk. And of course, he's quickly overcome by the fear and the anxiety of being surrounded by the wind and the waves and begins to sink. This is not about Peter needing more faith in his life. This is not about Peter, if only he had more faith, if only he'd kept his eyes firmly fixed on Jesus. No, this is about the fact that Peter made the mistake in getting out of the boat in the first instance. The boat, for Matthew, is the place of the church. The boat is the place where the community is meant to stay together. Jesus has promised at the beginning of Matthew's gospel that he will be Emmanuel. He will be God with them. At the end of Matthew's gospel, in the Great Commission, in Matthew 28, verse 20, we're told that Jesus again says to the community of the church that I will be with you always until the end of time. Where will he be? He will be in that boat. He will be in the midst of that church. He will be in that community as fragile and as frail and as full of fear and depression and anxiety and everything else that we in the church experience. But Jesus said, just stay in that boat and ride out those waves together. Stay as a community, regardless of the people that happen to be in the boat at the time. Just stay there and ride out those waves, and I will be there with you. I will allow you to come safely to the other shore. As in fact happens. Don't get out of that boat. Don't try and walk alone. Don't be tempting the Lord. Don't be trying to be equal to God. And just stay there and ride out and allow God to come to you in the still small voice, in the sound of sheer silence, in the whisper of the Lord speaking into my heart, into your heart. Allow the Lord to be with us today as we ride out those waves together. As we allow God to call us to be his community, a community not for ourselves, but a community on mission, a community about the crowd, about calling and inviting the rest of the crowd to come and to join us in this boat, to be the community of God together.